So welcome to King's Health Partners podcast series called KHP Heme Pearls. I'm Dr. Dipti Radia, Haematology Consultant at Guy's and St. Thomas's Hospital, and I'm delighted to be here with you again. Today's podcast will focus on high ferritin levels. I'm glad to introduce Dr. Neetha Prasannan, who's a consultant haematologist at Guy's and St. Thomas's, and will be talking us through some of the common queries primary care colleagues have around high ferritins and how to investigate further. So thank you for joining me today, Neetha, and I'll go straight in with our first question. So you know ferritin is a common requested blood test, and low ferritins are easier to interpret than the high ferritin levels. Can you talk us through some of the situations where we might see a high ferritin and what we might think about in terms of interpreting that, please?
Sure, thank you, Dipti. The simplest way that I like to split it up is when I'm presented with a raised ferritin, often in the form of advice and guidance through from primary care or referrals within the hospital, is one, how high is the ferritin? And then secondly, I like to look at the ferritin along with the iron studies, and particularly the transferrin saturation, because what I really want to know is, does this look like a reactive high ferritin, or could this be a suggestion of true iron overload?
Great. So you mentioned other tests to add. And so if it is reactive, and we use the phrase acute phase response for a lot of conditions, what points you towards a reactive? What other tests might you suggest? What should a GP look at or ask the question patients?
So the ferritin level is useful. Usually if it's, you know, significantly raised, I'd say above 1,000, you know, I'd be more worried than a slightly raised ferritin, less than 500, for example. And then the iron studies, so a normal transferrin saturation is often reassuring that the high ferritin is likely reactive. Other things that I'd look at, so the clinical history is always very important. Is there a history of infection here? Is the patient on antibiotics? And the full blood count, to look for whether there is anemia, is very useful. And often with an anemia of chronic disease, there's chronic inflammation, and we can see a raised ferritin in that setting. And the iron studies are particularly helpful in that scenario, because usually all the iron indices, so the iron level, the TIBC and the transferrin saturation, will all be low. Whereas, for example, if you had an iron deficiency, your TIBC would be elevated. Yeah, so often when we see these patients in clinic, we do a range of tests, which do include an ESR or a CRP. And we also often like check renal function, because other conditions associated with anemia of chronic disease, for example, CKD, diabetes, hypertension. So yes, and the one other test which I think is important or differential to bear in mind is malignancy. So a raised ferritin can be a marker of something more sinister going on. And then in terms of the exact investigations, we would be guided by the history.
Okay, so it always just comes back to the patient, doesn't it? Getting a really good, decent clinical history and following through. So if a patient has a high ferritin, we've talked about the other blood tests, you've mentioned the serum TIBC and transferrin saturations. Is there a level at which you think a GP should be worried and refer on?
Yeah, so generally speaking, I tend to use a ferritin cutoff of 500. But, you know, we're always happy to be consulted via, for example, advice and guidance consultant Connect, because often it's not as straightforward as that. But generally speaking, if there is a persistent unexplained high ferritin above 500, with or without transferrin saturation more than 50%, we advise for the patient to be referred, and we'd be happy to review them.
Okay, so that's having a conversation, because the actual range for a ferritin ranges in different centres, but it is from approximately 25 to 325. So it's a massive range, isn't it? And for it to be, and would you say if it was persistently above 500, because if somebody's had an acute reaction or a chest infection, it will go up?
Always the word persistently is, you know, a part of all our responses. A ferritin's persistently greater than 1,000 that we usually say, you know, just to refer straight on, because that's quite significant.
And would you want our colleagues in the community to do iron studies at the same time if they've got that, because that may help us in about moving on to the next bit, segueing into hemochromatosis. Would that be useful?
Yes, I think it would be very useful. In a significant portion of the referrals or advice and guidance queries we receive, we do now receive iron studies, which is excellent, because it just gives us a better picture. But if it's, if it's not something that's routinely done, I think it is a very helpful test.
Okay, so I guess moving on to the disease or the condition, it's not really a disease that worries everybody, it's about hemochromatosis. So what sort of ferritin levels, I know we keep talking about levels, would make somebody think about hemochromatosis as a potential diagnosis?
Yeah, so from, generally I tend to advise, again, a ferritin more than 500 or a persistently raised unexplained transferrin saturation more than 50%. The only caveat here is if there is a family history in a first degree relative, then the guidance is to test anyway, regardless of how high or normal the ferritin is. Yeah, so Northern Europeans, generally speaking, but I have to say in clinic, when we do get referred patients, we have rarely come across a carrier of hemochromatosis in other ethnicities. And some of these carrier genotypes can be associated with a slight or even up to 25% risk of iron overload. So for completeness, if I see a patient with an unexplained high ferritin, I tend to check it as part of the screen.
Old rules, don't we? And so suspicion of hemochromatosis, you're looking at, just to summarize, ferritins of above 500 and maybe a TIBC or a saturation of more than 50%. Any other suspicious things that GPs, what other blood tests might you recommend are done?
Yeah, so a liver function test always, because of the increased risk of cirrhosis, and then at the end of the spectrum, the risk of hepatocellular carcinoma. So when we see someone, we tend to check liver function test and an AFP as well. Other tests, so other organs which are damp, you know, are at risk of iron overload, so the pancreas, so we tend to check a random glucose to look for, you know, suggestion or suspicion of diabetes. The pituitary gland is another place where iron can deposit, and so we tend to check the gonadotropin, so LH, FSH, testosterone levels. Thyroid, we check thyroid. And then in terms of the clinical history, I often ask them, you know, do they have any symptoms to suggest any of these conditions? So thirsty, nocturia, and then any cardiac symptoms. It is rare to come across a patient, especially in the current era where patients are diagnosed quite promptly and managed. It's very uncommon to come across a patient with heart failure because of hemochromatosis, but it's just something important to bear in mind. So any cardiac symptoms, shortness of breath, chest pain, anything to suggest any form of heart failure.
Yeah, so I guess now that we know that the genetic test is available, we've got these iron indices, which are easier to investigate in the ferritin, and the index of suspicion is high, we get to the genetic test a lot quicker, and hopefully people haven't got significant end organ damage, but they can present to all sorts of disciplines, not just hematology, and a ferritin is a marker. I guess the next question is that, you know, does the genetic test always require a hematologist?
So I guess it depends who is able to send off bloods for the test. So often when we get, quite a lot of the GPs in our area, their bloods get sent to St. Thomas's, and so they are able to request a hemochromatosis screen. So if you are able to send it off from your end, great, and then they can liaise with us via advice and guidance or consultant connect. And if not, they need to be referred to a local hematology service.
Okay, that's great, because, you know, if you can and you can get that answer by the time the patient is referred, you've got some information already for some of these patients. They're really quite difficult to interpret sometimes, these genetic tests, in terms of their wording. So if patients are carriers, first of all, do they need to have venous sections? And is there a way that the TIBC and the saturations can help decide which patients are going to be carriers or homozygous?
Yeah, so carriers, I guess there's two ways of splitting that. There's carriers, and then there's patients with the actual condition who need venesection. So in terms of carriers, again, it depends on the type of carrier they are, the type of mutation they are. So for example, if there are C282Y heterozygote, then these individuals do have a 25% risk of iron overload. But generally speaking, carriers should not, often we should not assume that if they do present with iron overload, that it is because of this carrier status, and therefore it's important to look for other causes. And in some cases, when we need to, we send off a red cell gene panel to look for rarer causes of iron overload outside of hemochromatosis.
Okay, so if you had to kind of summarize the high ferritins, we talked about the investigations, and you had to summarize for hemochromatosis what GPs or what people in the community need to do and when to refer, what would that be?
So I think family history is very important, correlating the ferritin with the transferrin saturation. And if it's persistent, we'd be very happy for them to be referred for us to review these patients.
Just thinking, I guess within our catchment area, within our network, we have advice and guidance, and we've got consultant connect. So people can always phone. Yes. And feel free to phone to get some advice in order to be guided as to where to go. Yeah.
Yeah. And then just lastly, I guess, just important to bear in mind that it is an acute phase protein, and you know, it may not be an indicator of true iron overload. And so just to bear in mind, are there any red flag symptoms? Is there something else that, you know, a marker of, is there an underlying malignancy?
Great, brilliant, thank you. I think we've come to the end of our almost 10 minutes are over. So Anita, thank you very much for joining us today, and to our audience for listening. We hope you've learned something along the way with us. Please spread the word with your colleagues by sharing the podcast. We'd really appreciate it if you could leave a review and let us know if there are any topics you'd like us to focus for in future episodes. And we're very much looking forward to developing this KHP Heme Pearl series with your input. So please let us know if you'd like to be involved in future.